Welcome to The Digital Patient, where we discuss the latest advancements in digital patient engagement and share stories from the front lines. I'm your host, Alan Sardana, and with me as always is CMSMD CEO, Dr. Joshua Liu. Today, we're joined by our very special guest, Dr. Denise Basso. Dr. Basso is currently the Chief Digital Officer at Ochsner Health System. She joined Ochsner after a 25-year career with global information, software, and professional services leader Wolters Kluwer and healthcare startup UpToDate, where she leveraged innovation and technology to better care for patients' healthcare needs. Dr. Basso first joined UpToDate in 1996, progressing in leadership positions until being named General Manager after the company's sale to Wolters Kluwer in 2008. In that role, she grew the business into a large global evidence-based point-of-care medical software leader before forming a new business within Wolters Kluwer in 2015 called Clinical Effectiveness, where she served as the president and CEO. Now the world leader in clinical decision support and patient engagement, Clinical Effectiveness serves more than 2 million physicians globally and tens of millions of patients. Dr. Basso received her undergraduate degree from Duke University and her medical degree from Baylor College of Medicine. She completed her residency at Johns Hopkins University and practiced internal medicine for several years before joining UpToDate. Dr. Basso, Denise, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
I have to say, Denise, I am particularly excited. I think, you know, UpToDate was one of the products that, you know, I myself used in my training, everyone I know used it. So it honestly is an honor. I'm sure we're going to get a ton of folks excited to listen to this podcast.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Amazing. So Denise, where I wanted to start the conversation, you know, from the bio it was clear, you spent 2.5 decades using technology to empower patients and really providers with evidence-based best practices. And I'm curious, what was the turning point for you to decide to now focus on digitally engaging directly with patients?
Yeah, engaging patients has truthfully always been a passion of mine. And in fact, in addition to managing UpToDate, I also ran a patient engagement business as part of our portfolio. But that was all a pure technology play. And I really came to realize that the impact could be even greater if we combine technology with care teams and had a wet lab, if you will, to test those solutions. So health systems turn out to be fantastic wet labs to test different care models and different methods of engaging patients.
And Denise, before we get more into the patient stuff, I do have to get into the UpToDate piece because I think it's such an exciting part of your journey. Even physicians often find technology to be a roadblock to delivering, you know, patient care. So, I mean, I've met all kinds of clinicians who complain about EHRs and other, you know, IT systems. But UpToDate I found to be one of the exceptions where clinicians love using it all the time to deliver higher quality care. And I was wondering, what did building UpToDate teach you about designing products to become more of a must-have for clinicians?
Yeah, this will probably sound obvious, but first, the product has to serve an important need. It's hard to remember a time before UpToDate, but for those of us who are old enough to remember that, it was nearly impossible to find good information at the point of care, and UpToDate solved that problem. Second, the product has to be super easy to use. We had a pretty good model at the time. It was called Google. So we learned from that for sure. Third, it has to be really high quality so you can gain physicians' trust. We focused a lot on quality and it took really years and years to earn that trust. And then finally, you can't disappoint doctors. The first time it doesn't work for a doctor, they may give you a pass and come back again, but disappoint them a second time and they won't come back unless of course they're forced to.
I was wondering, when you were building out your initial team of editors, how selective were you in the experts you picked for different disciplines? Was it more about who was motivated at the time and was willing to commit all their, you know, resources and time? Or was it more about certain folks who you knew were, I don't know, key opinion leaders in the space? I was wondering what really mattered to frontline clinicians in terms of the expert level of the authoring.
Well, that's certainly changed over time. Initially we had to beg a bit, call on friends and family to work with us because of course nobody knew what it was. But over time, as it got to be better known and the impact of it, we began to understand, we were able to be a lot more selective. But what was really important to us is that we recruited people who were certainly expert in their fields, that was important. But they also needed to be clinicians, because we always said we were by clinicians for clinicians. And so it couldn't just be people that sat in an ivory tower and published. They needed to be both experts, but also really expert clinicians.
That makes a ton of sense. I was wondering from a more of a business lens, as an entrepreneur myself, was there a particularly important decision that you made that you think without it, UpToDate wouldn't have grown as large or as quickly as it did?
Oh boy, there were so many, as you know, and in an early business, there's so many important decisions that when you think back, any one of which could really materially change things. I guess one that I would pick was the decision not to slice UpToDate into different specialties. There was a lot of pressure to do that, both because of the cost of it, and especially after we were acquired by a publisher, a lot of pressure to sell it by individual specialty. But we stuck with what we knew, and we knew that patients don't always fit nicely into a specialty. They often have multiple problems. We knew that physicians used UpToDate outside their specialty as much as within their specialty. And so we never wanted to disappoint them by not having them find something. So we resisted the urge, we kept it all together. And that meant that physicians could virtually always find what they wanted. And that engendered a lot of that trust and loyalty that I talked about and kept them coming back.
Huh. That's a really interesting problem. I can't believe I hadn't thought about you having to do that at some point in terms of people trying to pressure you to split it up. But that makes a lot of sense that there'd be interest in that. The other question I was wondering was, lots of healthcare entrepreneurs sometimes have to wonder, well, when is it the right time for us to sell a company and exit? I mean, I think by that point you had been with UpToDate for at least over a decade, if I'm not mistaken, maybe quite a bit longer. What was the thought process in deciding the right time to sell?
I'm afraid I won't have a very helpful answer here. I had been there about 12 years, actually. We didn't really want to sell the company, if I'm honest, but our investors had been in it for more than a decade, which is a pretty long time for venture capital. So it was honestly their call.
Fair enough. And then I guess you stayed at Wolters Kluwer for quite a while afterwards, further building the organization. And you talked a lot, I think, and by the way, I have to give Alan a lot of the credit. He did a lot of the research on this. You talked a lot about the triple aim and how health systems can leverage technology to improve quality, cost, patient experience. And I believe you've shared in the past how one of the most critical challenges you faced was not around there being a lack of technology, but more of a lack of healthcare adoption of the technology. And we were wondering, given the rapid adoption we've seen since the pandemic, do you still think this is a roadblock today?
Well, first I need to applaud you for your research. So if that was all you, Alan, great job there. We're adopting technology more rapidly than ever now in healthcare. But I think the challenge now is figuring out how to get the most value out of that technology. One of the more interesting things that I've read about came from the Nobel Prize winning economist, Bob Solow. He introduced the concept of the productivity paradox to describe the observation in any industry, not limited to healthcare, that as more investment is made in information technology, worker productivity may go down rather than up. We have certainly seen this with the EHR in healthcare, now more than 10 years into that adoption curve. Now, the good news is that the productivity paradox gets better. And in most industries, this has apparently taken around 10 years. In healthcare, it will take longer. Some of that is because of regulation, HIPAA, the first do no harm philosophy that doesn't really tolerate failure. But I think what's been a really insightful reading for me is Bob Wachter. He's chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSF. And he's talked about two things that are required to unlock the productivity paradox. First, the technology gets better, and we all know that happens. But more importantly, what really unlocks it is reimagining the workflow itself. So think of Uber, think of Amazon. And so that's the real challenge, is reimagining that workflow to really achieve that value.
One of the things that's really, I think, bothered me a little bit about how we think about telemedicine and virtual care, particularly since the pandemic, is we keep thinking about telemedicine as a method of care delivery. And my hot take has been, well, you know, when we say telemedicine, we're really just saying video visits. I mean, some people are even calling phone calls telemedicine and virtual care. And in any other industry, the telephone, a video visit is simply a tool in the normal course of business. But in healthcare, we make it to be this really huge thing where it's its own form of care delivery. And in my mind, it should just be a tool in the toolbox. It shouldn't be some, you know, huge thing. I was wondering, do you view it the same way? Or maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe this is something that really should be seen as its own form of care delivery, and we should be emphasizing it that way.
Now, I think you and I are very much aligned here. I actually don't like calling it telemedicine. I prefer to call it, use kind of the superset of that, virtual care. Telemedicine denotes a synchronous visit using audio or video. And to your point, I'm not sure we should be patting ourselves on the back for that. I'm not diminishing or dismissing the value that it served during the pandemic in particular. It actually served us very well. But the broader opportunity in virtual care is really in reimagining the workflow, whether that's a synchronous in-person or telehealth visit that can be, you know, part of our tool chest, or asynchronous processes of at-home monitoring, data collection, and then interpretation and taking action on that data. So I think we really have to broaden the aperture from what we've experienced with telemedicine the last 2 years and move it to a true virtual care strategy if we want to improve quality and bend the cost curve.
I love that, Denise. It sounds like, you know, you're talking about disrupting the workflows from within, and by leveraging actual clinical folk, we can understand, you know, where is the gap in the current workflow and how can we leverage technology to actually improve upon that workflow, maybe through disruption. Part of your role as a chief digital officer is actually inspiring transformation from within and really, you know, understanding where are the problems today and how can we solve that maybe with technology. And I'm curious, do you have any effective strategies in how you actually build urgency from within the organization in inspiring a digital transformation?
I view it as a big part of my new job here. COVID really put what was a steady path towards digital transformation on steroids. The amount of investment that's currently happening in healthcare is increasing exponentially from startups to big tech. And this will most certainly result in disruption of care processes dramatically within the next 3 to 5 years. So my way of trying to build urgency is to communicate that message and to communicate that health systems are way better off if we disrupt ourselves than if we let others tell us how medicine should be practiced. Because one way or another, the disruption is going to happen. So we may as well do it. So that's kind of the message that I've been trying to evangelize around.
Yeah, I love that.
I love the idea of disrupting yourself. It reminds me of, this is not a healthcare example, but there was this very large software company that ended up carving out an internal team who very privately, in a very stealth way, created a directly competitive product to their core offering and went to market with it, didn't let anyone else in the company know that they had built this competitor, and they went after a target, I think, niche market of that they currently own to disrupt it. And the moment that they were disrupting themselves, they then basically migrated everyone to this new product and said, hey, by the way, we were the company that was disrupting ourselves. We kind of hit it, but we wanted to see if we could do it. So I love that concept of disrupting yourself before others in the market disrupt, you know, your health system. That's a really, really fascinating way to look at it. Yeah, go ahead, Denise.
And I say, you know, it's brilliant the way they went about it, because it's easy to say you want to disrupt yourself, but making that happen is much harder. So that's really brilliant.
You probably couldn't do that in Ochsner though, right? You probably couldn't have a stealth part of the health system with a different brand.
I think I need a slightly different strategy, but I'm working on it.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's great. Well, Denise, part of your decision, at least from what I've read, joining Ochsner, really stemmed from the notion that we're at this inflection point right now with patient care and healthcare, where COVID really, you know, as we've outlined and as the world knows, it really accelerated the need for virtual care technologies. And, you know, on top of that, we're juggling these new payment models. We're looking at value-based care models centered around these triple aims. And so stepping into the role of chief digital officer with a brand new health system, there's so many different aspects of digital transformation that you can take on and tackle. And so I'm curious, what's been your framework for identifying and prioritizing what to work on first?
Well, one thing I've gotten a strong lesson on in my first 3 months is that large health systems are complicated places, and there is a lot of change management that's required to move them. So far, it's been a short period of time, but so far my approach has been to really try to find a niche where we can operate within a well-defined group of clinicians and care processes, try to experiment with different technologies and care models, learn, hopefully have some success, and then bring that success back to the rest of the system. So found a couple of niches that I think we're going to focus on first. And with that, I'm also really laser focused on capitated and at-risk populations. Value-based models are ideally suited to digital disruption. So those are some of the areas I'm trying to focus.
How much walking the hallways are you doing in your first 3 months here? I know maybe it's a little bit different during COVID, but are you going around the system very much, like randomly popping into different departments, or how do you end up getting a deeper view into all the different things going on?
I've had a really fascinating and busy onboarding. It's been probably less physical walking around, in part because of COVID, although that's fortunately now beginning to ease up a bit, but definitely been spending a lot of time with clinical leaders across the organization. It's a really impressive, very thoughtful group of people. And honestly, because of the innovative culture at Ochsner that started way before I got here, I can't take credit for that. Really a group that is willing to try and wants to try and is open to trying new things. So it's been more metaphorical walking the halls, but there's definitely been a lot of engagement with the clinical teams here. And that's, again, very much a culture at Ochsner.
Yeah, lately, like Al and I have had some fantastic guests who've been in industry and then moved into the health system space. With Walters Kluwer and Ochsner, both are, very large, enterprises, lots of people, lots of, complexities, I'm sure. Has there been one, despite both being large, has there been one major difference that you've noticed so far in terms of what it's like operating at a health system versus a large healthcare business?
At the end of the day, a lot of what we're doing here at Ochsner and implementing are products, but there isn't necessarily that mindset around products. It's not necessarily thought of that way. So I think, when you think of things in terms of products, there's a little bit of a different urgency around some things. There's a little bit of a different mindset. I'm trying to bring a little bit of that product culture while also not disturbing what is, really been a very successful kind of innovation and, culture of just really providing high quality care. So really, I think just trying to marry all of those things together.
Yeah, I love that. Denise, it's interesting when you were chatting earlier about, producing a sense of urgency from within the organization. You're talking about sharing the right information. You're talking about, providing the facts, and here's the message where we're going in 3 to 5 years. You actually had a really great conversation with Dr. Pat Salver on the Dr. Ways In This was back at the end of 2020, but you discussed six important factors to consider when dealing with the ocean of information that's available today. I'll just quickly summarize it. So number one, you were talking about acquiring and synthesizing the information. Number two, having that information vetted by relevant experts. Number three, including peer review in the synthesis process to avoid bias. Four, to be transparent with any recommendations. And then five, balance speed and rigor. And finally, six, make the information easy to find and digestible into the workflow. And so really my question is, today consumers are seeking out and sharing information widely. We've seen it on social media. You know, it's been obviously a hot topic over the last 2 years, talking about misinformation and different information being shared. And so with that, obviously, there's a potential harm for the population as we've witnessed. And so my question is really, what role do you see health systems playing in confronting this health misinformation? And what are some of the biggest challenges in your mind that we have in rebuilding some of the public trust?
Yeah, I can't believe that conversation with Pat was over a year ago. Time has become a little bit meaningless, hasn't it? You know, I think aside from the you know, obvious horrible loss of life and well-being suffered during COVID, this acceleration and broadening of misinformation and mistrust of health systems may have the most damaging long-term impact. Unfortunately, there's no easy button for gaining that trust back. It will be a journey of transparency with consumers, of inclusion, and of partnering with them on health and wellness. And I guess it would also help if we made things a little less complicated to get access to and pay for high quality care. We can't keep putting patients in the crossfire between payers, providers, and our government, quite frankly.
One of the neat things about UpToDate was that because of the brand, which, you know, was built over, you know, decades and built because of the quality of evidence behind it, et cetera, you know, clinicians trust what comes from UpToDate. There are, you know, a bunch of, I don't know, consumer facing, let's call them healthcare education websites. I don't know, you can go like WebMD and all kinds of other things. I was curious, do you think it's possible at this point to have a public-facing, consumer-friendly patient health education, you know, resource of this type? Or does that only work with clinicians because they understand the evidence, they value the evidence and the expertise behind it? So should we just stick to that with things like UpToDate? Or do you think there's a role that, or do you think it's actually possible to do this for the consumer aspect?
I think it's possible to get things right and to do them well. You have to, that has to be a primary focus, but with the, you know, the right focus and the right process and the right people, absolutely, all of that is possible. I think with physicians, you know, there's a method to practicing evidence-based medicine, and we're all taught how to evaluate evidence in medical school. And so, you know, they're able to recognize what's good. Physicians can recognize what's good. And you know, and so it's easier to kind of get that point across and build that trust. With consumers, there's so much coming at them and so many sources of that information, you know, kind of breaking through and you know, helping them understand what's it's become political. I mean, you know, of all things. So I think it's possible to create it, but how you drive adoption and, you know, and earn that trust with consumers, it's, you know, I think it's much more difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, we had, just to give you a little bit of lore, back in the day and, you know, at UpToDate, we had this notion that we could sell to patients. That not everybody, but if you or somebody that you loved had a really serious illness, you learn the language of your illness and you can read what your doctor reads. And it turned out that we were terrible at knowing how to sell to consumers, that were, you know, non-clinical consumers. So that was one issue. But more importantly, it was just really hard to differentiate why up-to-date information would be different than anything else they could get for free on the internet. So it's less about creating it and more about how you build that trust. I think it's much more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Denise, I think one of the helpful things when it comes to communicating with clinicians is that to what you said, there is a pyramid of levels of evidence, and so clinicians care less about maybe who's saying it, but they care more about, well, where does it stack along the pyramid of evidence requirements? Like let's say it was an RCT versus a prospective trial versus something else, and it's and so you can look at the actual data more, regardless of who's the one who's saying it. But I think I found that when the consumer, sometimes who says it lately has a much bigger impact than what is said. And, I've even seen cases now where, and by the way, I disagree with this, where I've seen some, physicians say, well, why stop trusting an economist, trust a physician on this topic. And it's like, well, let's be honest, there are some physicians who've also spread health and misinformation. And so, having an MD is helpful, but not in every case. And so I think even from a clinical point of view, we have to go back to, okay, well, first, let's forget who's saying it. Let's focus on the data, because if we debate the data, I think we'll be okay. But if we always keep pointing back to like who's saying it matters, then you run into trouble where people always go back to, whoever's validating what they believe in the first place. And so I don't quite know how we can get consumers to have a framework where they look more at the data. But it is something that we somehow have to get to maybe to build that trust, but it is a tough topic. Definitely don't have a good answer for it.
I wish I had an answer. I don't really either, but I think, as I said, I do think this is going to be a long-term, I mean, it was already happening, but certainly a long-term fallout from the pandemic. And I think again, see some of the disruption happening. I think as part of that, and as we evolve care models and just make life easier for patients, I think we can start to build some of that trust back.
That's a great point. It's gonna be hard work, but it's important work. So you've been at the center, Denise, of technological innovation for the past, we said 2.5 decades. And as you know very, very well, there's this explosion now of patient-facing technologies, which you've highlighted. So whether that's digital care journeys guiding patients before and after surgery, whether it's chatbots on hospital websites now to better triage patients towards services, I'm sure you're seeing all kinds of things. What sorts of patient-facing technologies have excited you most lately?
I don't know if there's a particular technology that I'm excited about, although I am excited about the possibilities that data can bring us. I mean, we're now collecting gigabytes, terabytes. I just learned the term yottabytes. I think that's how you say it. data. But we've yet to really harness it in ways that materially change care. But I do think that day is coming, and it will be required if we truly want to see effective transformation. So whether that's using real world patient data to augment our evidence base, whether it's transforming our patient conversations using AI into better medical documentation and therefore communication. Some of that's already starting to happen. Better recognizing patterns that allow us to reduce diagnostic and treatment errors and again, better engage patients with that. That use of data is what I'm really looking forward to. And I actually think, tying this to our prior conversation, when we do go back to data, and these are the type of data that we can share with patients and that are much easier to understand than a randomized controlled trial, I think it will ultimately help facilitate some of those conversations.
That's a really, really great point. I was wondering, Denise, I know we talked a lot about, value-based care, and you have a big interest in, managing at-risk populations better. Do you think that we need to keep growing out the amount of value-based care happening in order to get better adoption of digital and new innovations as a needing as a driver? Or is this ongoing shift to in consumerism in healthcare enough of a driver on its own that even the whole value-based care piece kind of stays about the same? The rising expectations of consumers as patients, is that going to be enough, you think, going forward to get more folks doing digital?
I think we need value-based care. I mean, consumerism will certainly continue to drive things. But I really think that value-based care is the tipping point. Now, maybe I'm in that circumstance taking a bit of a health system focused view of the world, but I can tell you, working now in a health system that has, I think the metaphor is one foot in both canoes of fee-for-service and value-based care, it is extremely challenging. And as we're trying to transform some of those care models or just drive adoption of technologies, still in the back of everybody's mind is, we have to survive and how are we going to do that? And it does tend to, it can impact how you implement things or just the process of implementing these things. So I think the technology really has the promise of improving quality. We can improve quality in a lot of ways, but also bending the cost curve. But that bending of the cost curve really only happens in a value-based world, in my opinion. So we can do number one, we can improve quality with digital transformation and doesn't matter what kind of insurance you have. But if we really want to bend the cost curve, I think the moving to value is critical.
The other piece I found too is that for certain clinical champions who, as you know very well, is key for adoption of these new innovations, I think we found that there are a lot of clinical champions who are incredibly passionate about improving quality, whether because there's value-based care, reimbursement, or because they're just genuinely passionate about improving patient outcomes. So I think to your point, even just to get adoption from your frontline staff, that aspect of value-based care of quality, I think could be a really important motivator. Otherwise, if all you're doing is improving maybe basic operational efficiencies, I mean, people like that too, but I think some of your clinical champions may not be as motivated if there's no, value-based care or quality aspect to the innovation. And that, this could actually get you better adoption if the quality piece is aligned as well. So I think that's a really, really great point.
Yeah. So Denise, you actually, I keep bringing up old things that you've talked about, but this one was really impactful, and I'm curious to get your take on it today. So you previously shared five changes that you would like to make to improve the overall U.S. health system, and we're just talking now about value-based care, so I thought this was an opportune time. The five changes that you had suggested were: one, interoperability; two, making healthcare affordable for everyone; three, empowering patients to be part of their care team; four, promote evidence-based care everywhere; and five, target chronic conditions. And so some of these changes are obviously easier said than done. But now that COVID has happened, I'm curious, would you change this list at all? Would you maybe add a sixth one, or would you keep it all those five still?
I think the list still holds pretty well. The obvious addition would be to improve our public health infrastructure. COVID definitely shined a light on our deficiencies there. And I would probably, again, getting back to the earlier conversation, I'd probably add developing meaningful insights from data and really converting these insights into actions that improve value. We've now digitized the system, we have to start really getting the value from that.
Yeah.
I guess, do you foresee something right now when I think about medical education? I don't think things like data science are a core part of curriculum, even to this day. Do you think that's going to become a real part of the curriculum going forward for clinicians, or do you think that's going to be left more to the data scientists?
I think the the data scientists will always obviously be the true experts there, but I do see in the health system here, I do see a push to including more types of programming around data, around just digitizing healthcare in general. I think that's starting to shift a bit. And frankly, I think the students find it pretty interesting. So so I think that's kind of a win-win on both sides.
I love that. Denise, the final question that I had, I'm sure Josh might have some more, but a question that I had, if you could give advice to any other digital leaders out there in healthcare regarding adopting a virtual care strategy, a telehealth strategy, a digital front door strategy, whatever you want to call it, this umbrella, what would your advice be?
Yeah, I think it goes back a bit to what I said earlier about just broadening the aperture of what we've considered to be telehealth. I think it really ties together all of the things that we've spoken about already, which is this isn't about using one tool in a tool chest. This is really about changing our workflows and changing our care models. And that's really hard to do, but we have to be brave enough to do it and reimagine some of those things. So again, let's not call it telehealth. Let's call it virtual care. And let's, I like having care in there because it implies really the models that we use. So let's start having that discussion.
Yeah, I love that.
I think that's a great point. I think my hope is that one day this would become so much of the norm that you don't have to put the word virtual in front of care. It should just be assumed that if you're getting healthcare, it might include some virtual digital elements. So I think that's a great point. I did have one.
I say that's an even better way to say it.
Yeah, definitely. Before we get to the fast five lightning round, I did have one more question, Denise. And your story is just incredible. I mean, going from medicine just a few years later, you went to UpToDate, the startup, then you ran this big organization, Optus Clure, and now you're leading digital at a health system. And so for someone like yourself to have the courage and the boldness to take a very unconventional path, I think sometimes I've noticed that folks like yourself have, clues in their earlier history growing up or through school where when you look back, you realize, it's not so surprising that Denise went down this unconventional route. So I was curious, prior to, going to UpToDate, were there clues looking back in your history that, maybe you went rogue several times in something, or you were just unconventional? Like, anything happened before that would make this not seem like such a surprise?
Yeah, that's a great question. First, I would say that I tell people all the time, there's a thin line between bravery and stupidity. So sometimes you just have to get lucky and end up on the right side of that. I don't know if anybody would have ever described me as someone who would go rogue, but I definitely was someone who was always willing to take some calculated risks. It's not as it's taking chances isn't about doing stuff in a kind of crazy, unthoughtful way. You can take a chance and still be very data-driven and thoughtful about it. So I think it's about taking some calculated risks and imagining what might happen if you fail. I spend a lot of time in my, as I'm lying in bed, not sleeping or going on walks, I spend a lot of time thinking through scenarios and how things can go wrong. I probably think about that more than I think about how they go right. And as I think back, I think I've always done that. And so there comes a point when you understand the risks, but you're kind of willing to, the downsides, presuming you've calculated that right, the downsides don't seem that bad. And so I don't think it's, I would ever say go rogue, but I would say I've always thought through the downsides and every risk that I've taken, I've been willing to accept the fact that those downsides might happen and I might fail, but that it's okay.
I love that. So you go into it, not that you're going to be delusional that these, let's say, bad outcomes can happen, but you accept the potential consequences that could happen and you're comfortable with that possible outcome going into it. I was wondering, when you think about imagining all the ways something could fail, is part of that the idea that, hey, you know what, if I can identify all of the major risks to this decision, I can then mitigate all those specific risks and therefore maximize the chance that it works out. Is that part of the calculus as well? Or is that, am I totally off on that?
No, that's absolutely part of it. And you can't control everything. That's for sure. But you have a much better shot at controlling some things if you've identified them up front and go at them. And that's, I think, been, again, part of every major decision that I've made.
Amazing.
Great. Alan, so yeah, awesome. Let's we're gonna flip over to what we call the Fast Five Lightning Round. It's basically just five questions to get to know you better for our audience. So the first question we have, Denise, what is your favorite book or book you've gifted the most?
I've had a really good run of books lately. So this is a difficult one to choose. The one that I've probably recommended the most is the audio version, and this is important, but the audio version of Born a Crime, which was written by and then narrated by Trevor Noah. It's really, it's laugh out loud funny, but it's also filled with a ton of life lessons as he talks about his story growing up poor in South Africa at the twilight of apartheid, and then, to achieving star power in the US. So just a really great story, and listening to him narrate it is phenomenal.
I bet, yeah, that's great. Question two, how has an apparent failure set you up for greater success?
Again, so many mistakes and so little time, how to choose. I would say this is a little bit of a heavy moment, but it was a really important one for me. It actually occurred during my residency, so many years ago, but it still stands out to me like it happened yesterday. I was a second year resident in charge of the ICU, probably the most senior person in the hospital at the time, which is a little bit crazy thinking back. Again, this was many, many years ago. And I turned down admitting a patient from the emergency department to the ICU who suffered a cardiac arrest. We were able to resuscitate him, but it was a really powerful lesson to me. I turned him down for admission to the ICU in part because I was inexperienced and missed some important signs of how sick he was. But I also turned him down because I was getting pressure from the ICU staff to not fill the last bed that we had available. And even though in my gut, I felt like I had made the wrong decision before we coded, I still made that decision. So my lesson was to never dismiss the available data and to trust my gut once the data told me everything that it could. So I think, and probably we've talked about this a little bit already, but that lesson is really applicable to virtually every day of my personal and professional life.
It's a really powerful story, Denise. Do you mind if I ask you a very data related follow-up, since I know you're into the data? Do you, because to your point, we're gonna get all kinds of new data in the coming years. We're gonna build better and better algorithms. There's gonna be more machine learning involved in how we deliver care. And so you could imagine a future where in that specific situation, there is an algorithm that calculates, let's call it a recommended solution. And at some point in the future, clinicians could rely so much on these algorithms and what the data says that they stop relying on their instinct, which probably has a lot of underlying experience that contributes towards that instinct. Is that something that you think we need to be, I don't say concerned, but thoughtful about as you think about training the clinicians of the future? Like, I guess, how do we maintain clinician instinct and judgment when we're increasingly relying on what could be very smart algorithms, I guess, to help us make decisions? I was curious if you had any thoughts about how you think about that kind of future.
Yeah, it's a great point. I haven't, to be honest, I haven't spent a long time or a lot of time thinking about it, but as you were talking, it reminds me a bit of what's happening now in the airline industry, right? Where there's concern, do pilots know how to react in unusual situation since everything is so controlled. I don't think we'll ever get to that point of control within healthcare. You know, healthcare is more complicated than airplanes, but I do think it's something that we need to be thoughtful of and mindful about. So a good thing for me to ponder.
Great. Question three is a bit different. Would you rather have super strength, super speed, or the ability to read people's minds?
People say I can already read their minds. So I think I would choose super speed. I love moving fast. I drive fast. I cycle, I ski. Those tend to be my happy places.
So you want to go faster? That's what you're saying.
I want to go faster, yeah. Well, I like going fast, but I wouldn't say I have super speed in any of those things, right. But I would like to.
That's great. Question four, what is something in healthcare you believe that others might find insane?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'm not sure if people would categorize this as insane, but I'm also not sure many clinicians in particular currently believe this. But I really believe that we're going to bring the joy back to medicine. The last decade of EHR challenges, the pandemic, the ensuing burnout, the great resignation, I mean, all of this has really beaten down our providers. But I'm pretty optimistic that we can change that narrative. I think we're going to come out the other side. We're going to make life easier for our providers and for our patients. And again, bring that joy back.
Oh, I love that. I really appreciate your optimism. It's been a common thread throughout this whole conversation. And I tend to agree with exactly what you were saying there. The last question that we have of the Fast Five, this is a pandemic lockdown related question. What is one hobby or activity you've gotten into since the beginning of the pandemic?
Birds. I've actually gotten into birds. I made the seemingly innocent decision to put a bird feeder outside my office window so I wouldn't have to look at the same thing every day. Now fast forward and I have an app that uses AI to identify the birds. So I'm constantly interrupting meetings to take pictures of my birds, really are. I have really unexpected, endless moments of joy watching them. I name them, I learn about them, and also get disappointed when they disappear for a while. But that's been one of the fun parts of the pandemic for me.
Is this a new interest, or did you have this prior to the pandemic?
I had zero interest. In fact, I really hated birds, actually. I had a very bad experience as a child I know this is a podcast and you can't see me, but I have very curly hair. And I had this friend who had a bird, and I think that bird always thought that my very curly hair was a nest and used to just fly on my head. And so I actually hated them. So this was now, my bird feeder is obviously outside my window. It's not in my house, so I don't have to get that close to them. But no, this was a totally new thing for me.
That's awesome.
That is pretty awesome. I think another really kind of cool data point here, Denise, you're actually the second person on the show who's had that same hobby since the beginning of the pandemic. There was another gentleman who had birding as his. That's his interest. It's really awesome. Cool. Who would have thought? And it's really interesting because, like you said, you've identified so many different birds now. Whereas most people, they look up, you know, in their backyard or whatever, and there's a bird. You know, there. I know a pigeon. I know a seagull. I know, you know, a handful of birds. But I think that's really awesome that you can actually identify all these different sounds and all these different birds. That's really cool.
Yeah, we happen to have a variety of woodpeckers, and I didn't know there were that many woodpeckers, but they're pretty cool creatures.
That's awesome. Mm. Well, amazing. Denise, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, not just for the Fast Five lightning round, all the insights that you provided throughout the conversation. You know, your takeaway knowledge of really disrupting yourself from within the organization, I think, is super profound. A lot of insight that I took away from this conversation, and I really hope that our audience can take some away as well. So thank you very much for sharing your time with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's really, really my pleasure.
That's great. Thank you, everyone. That's a wrap for this episode of The Digital Patient, hosted by SeamlessMD. Follow us on Twitter at SeamlessMD. If you like the podcast and want to learn more, please visit www.seamless.md.